This is Jack Leffler. Many Indian people on our continent have strongly resisted being spiritually and intellectually subsumed by the dominant culture and its governing bodies. Many have expressed that they perceive the collective attitude inherent in Western culture as biased mainly by science, technology, politics, and a system of economics intent on turning habitat into money, regardless of the consequences. Virtually all Indian cultures have been guided primarily by the spirit of nature. While some Indian people have embraced the anthropomorphic religion introduced to the Western Hemisphere in 1492, many more have retained the spiritual attitudes which have sustained them for thousands of years. In this way, they perpetuate the spirit of place. Indian people have lived within the watershed of the Columbia and Snake River system for at least 12,000 years. Over the last century, they have seen their homeland and waterways violated by timber, agricultural, and mining industries, the construction of a series of dams, and the presence of the Hanford facility, which discharges nuclear waste into the river. Many fail to understand the mentality of a culture that seems oblivious to such acts of abuse against the environment. Instead, the earth is seen by them as a living organism who gave birth to all species. People who live close to the flow of nature know intuitively that wanton destruction of habitat and thoughtless introduction of toxic materials weakens the health of the ecosystem upon which we all rely.
There's sunlight, and there's earth, you know, the mineral earth, and water. Three basic elements. Without those three elements, you would not have life at all. See, when the sunlight comes and it touches Mother Earth, you know, the mineral soil, but it needs water. And when you add water to that, sunlight, earth, water, that's the creation of life. And all the species are connected to that. So if it wasn't for sunlight, we wouldn't have life. If it wasn't for Mother Earth, we wouldn't have life. And if it wasn't for water, we wouldn't have life. East is significant for us. When the sun rises in the morning, it gives us a light for that day. And then it goes through the heavens and goes around. Then it's nighttime. My dad always used to complain. He said, "Oh, these non-Indians, they always say that we're worshiping the sun." Well, we are, because it gives us light and strength. But we also realize the sun was placed in that position by our Creator. We honor the sun for what it provides. Everything's connected to those three elements.
The way that I was taught was that we were the last, therefore the youngest creatures put on this earth, and I think even our creation legend reflects that. And while at birth, we are giving some abilities and some knowledge, we don't have all the strength and knowledge to survive in this world. And so who do we always turn to learn these skills, to gain this knowledge, to survive? We turn to our elders. And our elders are those older living beings like the plants and the animals who were here long before us. And so I think that creates dependency upon nature then that is different. A dependency, spiritual and physical, but also some of the things that we can look to nature, those lessons of everyday life, community, courage and passion, devotion, those types of things. When you look at the livelihood of the animals and we could draw from their examples, it teaches us something about life. I think the way that we look at the environment is, you know, we don't look at it for its economic properties. You know, we've always understood that we didn't have dominion over nature. We weren't out to conquer nature because actually nature was our caretaker, our provider. In my personal view is to dispel this notion that the American Indian was a natural resource manager long before the coming of the Europeans. We did not manage nature. We didn't make the salmon run. We didn't make the berries and the foods, the medicines grow. Actually, because we responded to nature, to the change in seasons. So actually, I feel that nature managed us. Because we put our welfare into the hands of our Creator and then into the hands of nature, our caregiver. And so I always feel that it's always been the other way around. that nature managed us and provided for our livelihood.
I think that the greatest jeopardy that we see as far as the natural habitat has got to be our rivers, our water. The pressures that, the development of the West has placed upon the waterways, you know, the dams for power generation, for irrigation, to provide for barge traffic, those types of things. We look at the headwaters, the impacts of mining, logging, and grazing have put tremendous burdens upon our stream systems. You know, salmon to the Nez Perce was like the buffalo to the plains. You change the water, you change the salmon. When you change the salmon, you change the Nez Perce people. And I think our river systems are those things that we need to focus our strongest attention to. Before we can truly heal the land, we need to learn to care for ourselves and for one another. Because it was the feeling that as we learned to abuse ourselves and one another, we lost sight of living within nature's limits because we wanted to gain more than we dare leave behind. And with that mentality, I think we started pushing ourselves into kind of the spiritual bankruptcy. And with that, we lost sight of our, like, a moral obligation to nature. And so we see our rivers being dammed up. We see pesticides being put onto the land, which pollutes the aquifer and gets into our river systems. You know, we see the storage of nuclear waste adjacent to river systems. And there needs to be almost a refocus in our relationship with each other as human beings. And once we create that healthy relationship, then I think we can begin to do a better job of focusing on how we heal the environment. We see so much fractionation in this country, you know, with the different interests. Freedom has been a great thing for this country, but in essence, freedom has left us a little bit vulnerable. You know, freedom has allowed this country to be built on a variety of heritages, you know, the mining heritage, the farming heritage, the timber heritages, but also we have religious and ethnic heritages, you know, including Indian people. And freedom has allowed that to happen, but the vulnerability of that is that with this, that some heritages have been built at the expense of another. Some are held more politically sacred. So we have these conflicts that arise and this division within our communities. The thing to focus on is that we are blessed with many heritages, but we only have one Mother Earth, and that's the earth upon which we prove ourselves to our Creator. And so we need to work harder at reconciling these human differences that exist between us. And once we start reconciling those differences, then I truly think that we become cohesive enough to really just take a deliberate and sincere effort to restore the natural ecosystem that not just the Nez Perce depend on, but really all of this country depends on.
I know a little bit about Hanford. You know, they do discharge acceptable levels of radiation into the Columbia River system. Is this acceptable level of radiation really acceptable? It's maybe acceptable for this generation of people that utilize resources out of the Columbia River. But what about succeeding generations? I think we're trying to cover it up by saying it doesn't exist when we bury it. It's just saying that let's not contend with this problem right now. We should contend with this problem right now. Like any other resource, we need to be involved with the restoration and protection of resources right now rather than pass it on to the next generation to worry about. Why don't we accept a little bit of pain right now so that 5 or 6 generations down the line that they have to suffer pain that's 100 times of what we have to suffer now? We're comfort-seeking species. How many go over and turn off the power to their house to save trees or to, you know, save some kind of species? It's the whole public that's got to be educated. You know, at least say there's an ecosystem, sustainable resources that got to be protected and enhanced for the benefit of all mankind. You know, nuclear waste is a major issue. You know, bury it, get it out of the site, and it'll go away. It's not going to go away. Half-life of nuclear waste is 10,000 years. So all we're doing is passing that problem on to some generation thousands of years down the road. You know, for some catastrophic event to occur that will expose people to radiation. Or it will seep into aquifers. They say rock will hold it. Well, I don't think it would. But if there's a catastrophic event, things are going to change very rapidly. There's a lot of farming, you know, herbicides, insecticides, fertilizers that go into the Columbia River system. And we eat the salmon that comes out of this Columbia River system. So it's affecting us. It may not affect me because I don't look sick right now. But I eat that salmon, and I don't know what it's doing to me. You know, it may not affect me, you know, in my lifetime, but it may affect grandchildren or great-grandchildren. And they say at acceptable levels because we don't turn sick right now. We got to think further ahead than just a five-year plan. Most businesses and corporations and organizations say, well, let's develop a five-year plan. Why don't we develop that into a 150-year plan? Plus, many generations from us, seven generations from what we're doing right now, why don't we plan for that seventh generation? Because that's the one that's going to accept everything that we do today. That generation will be the most affected. And nobody can think that far ahead. Because a corporate way of thinking today is only 5 years, maybe 10 or 15.
We can't discount totally the value of Western science and technology. You know, we have this wisdom that goes way back, and what we need to do is combine this wisdom with this newfound science and technology to guide the care of our land and our communities. So we need to do a better job of combining those two together, and one should not be displaced or pushed aside at the expense of another.
The Indian village of Salilo was a major trading center since time out of mind. Peoples from myriad tribes gathered there to fish at Salilo Falls, trade, and socialize. It was there that alliances were sealed, marriages were arranged, and traditional gambling was practiced. Salilo Falls was a geophysical site that factored into many legends and provided the mythic parameters that held Indian cultures in place. Such was the strength of Salilo Falls. In 1957, a newly constructed dam resulted in the flooding of this ancient site, and many found themselves both physically and spiritually displaced. The flooding of Salilo Falls was regarded by some as an act of madness, by others as yet one more act of infamy committed by the prevailing government, and by everyone as a consummate tragedy.
I think Salilo was one of the greatest trading points for this whole Northwest because they traded everything. And did you know that some Nez Perce traded and got a Klamath woman? She come up here, and the people, some of them that live up to Orfino, have Klamath blood in them. They traded people because a lot of them gambled, and they just gambled everything. And they had horse races. It must have been a real crowded place. This old lady that I talked to said that her grandmother told them that it was so crowded sometimes that you didn't have any place to put your fish. A lot of times people went there for the purpose of trading, if they had something and they wanted something. And that was a purpose of the Nez Perces being a transitional people. They could bring down buffalo hides from the plains, and they could bring white turnips. They had dried buffalo meat that anybody would just give anything for, and for the hides. And they traded for generations and generations, because even from Northern California, people come up there to trade. And that's where they learned about horses. And the Nez Perces, when they heard about it, before they had horses, they sent four men down there to look for horses. And they got them and brought them back.
Salilo was a great gathering place. I remember when I was a youngster in my teens, there were all types of tribes. They were from Montana, from Idaho, Oregon, Washington, even some from clear down south as Klamath Falls. All came to fish there, and it was a place there where they made a living. The main culture was Yakima and Warmsher, the two most dominant tribes here. But like people, you know, intermarriages, a lot of them, like my father, intermarried with Nez Perce. So that's how he got to be here.
When we used to go fishing, we used to go down to Salilo Falls, and that was another really nice experience. I'm beginning to understand why we have a lot of social problems on the reservation. A lot of our legends and value and beliefs with the Wasco people and the Warm Springs people who also came from further upriver from the Wascos, we lost a lot of our culture when we were moved to the reservation. I was about 5 or 6 years old. Well, we used to always travel down to the river during the spring and the fall runs because all our family was down there and everybody was fishing. And this was just before most of the dams were built and we still had good salmon runs. My mother took me and my older sister, and it was a real hot day. The falls, whenever you have all of these falls and they come down in all this basalt rock, the spray, it just creates this huge spray. And it was always nice to go down there because of this spray. It's real hot and you go, and dry. We hardly have any humidity. And you go down to the falls and there's all this humidity from the spray. Well, my mother always took us down, but she never took us from on top down to where the falls were. Well, this time she decided to take me and my sister down. This is all basalt rock. So the fishermen had put planks of wood down. And you had to be careful because when the mist came up and got the boards, the planks wet, it would be slippery. So my mother took us partway down. As we got closer to the falls, the roar of the falls was so loud that she told us she didn't want to take us any further because we wouldn't be able to hear her talk. So she said, you stay here and wait till I come back and don't move, just stay here. So she had us hold hands, so we stayed there. And my mother walked away from the falls and I think she went like no more than 6 feet away and she disappeared in the mist. That's just how close we were to the falls and in the mist. Later, she told us that when she went down there, she would have to talk with sign language. They also had a sign language to bargain in. She had to ask directions on where her relatives were fishing. So she would go down the mist, and every time she'd see these misty figures, she would stop them and ask them with sign language where so-and-so's scaffold was so she could go and get salmon there. Well, when my sister and I were standing waiting, as the wind shifted, the mist would also shift, and it covered it. It would cover us, and then it would go away, and it would cover us. And we love that sensation. But what I really remember visually from the falls, you were just like in a different world. You didn't know up from down, left from right. And the sun was shining, and the mist was going. And as the mist was moving, there would be these little circle rainbows. They were just dancing around. And as the sunshine moved or and the mist moved, then they'd either disappear or they'd move. And I remember that so vividly. It was such a neat experience.
My dad came here in 1939, and he was walking down the Dalles on 2nd Street where the Chamber of Commerce. He said he saw a picture of the Dalles Dam. And he went to tell the elders of Salilo, they're going to build a dam out here. He saw drawings of it, and they said, no, it never happened because we're under this treaty of 18-something. They were under this treaty. But he says, the way it goes, it looked like he's got the okay of the government. They already had the sign, stroke of the pen, and they're going to do it. They didn't say, no, you don't know what you're talking about. But sure enough, it happened. That was way back in 39, 38 or something, 41, when my dad saw that. And my dad talked about that quite a bit.
It was a real hardship for them to move. We were up around the Dalles area, right around Salila Falls, and we were sort of the key people that did the trading with all of the tribes that came up and down the Columbia River. And as I mentioned a little earlier, the Columbia River and the tributaries were like freeways and highways, and they all met in that area. One of the reasons the Wascos were a key trading tribe was because of all of the fish, the salmon. And after literally tons and tons of salmon were harvested, that location was really crucial for drying and preparing the salmon. There were these real dry east winds that came down the river. So you could catch a lot of fish, you know, down around the mouth of the Columbia River, but you didn't have the dry winds to really preserve the fish. So after we caught all the salmon, then we dried the salmon, and then we would pound it into a powder. So you'd get this huge 40-50 pound salmon, dry it, which would dehydrate it. Then you get maybe half its weight. And after you got the dried meat from the salmon, then we would pound that. So you get this huge salmon, and it would fill up a little basket, just a little, like, 8-inch basket, 6 inches in diameter, 8 inches high. And that's what we traded, and that's what all the people came to trade, was the salmon. So the Wasco people were well known for the trade that they did, and then that's where our tradition of weaving the baskets came from, because we were constantly trading not only the salmon, but the salmon was stored in the baskets, and we were trading the baskets and the salmon together. So at that time, there was no way we could lose the skill of making the baskets. We just had to make them all the time. So historically, we were training people, and we were well known for our baskets because we had those geometric designs, which were real characteristic of the Wasco people. And after the treaties were signed and we were moved south about 100 miles to the Warpsumas Reservation. So that move was real traumatic culturally to our tribe. Our history, our culture, our legends were all based on the Columbia River. And almost all of our Wasco stories tie in with the Columbia River. And after we moved, we still had the right to go back to the river to fish. We also have the right to go out and dig roots and collect the different fibers for whatever uses we want, primarily for basket making. But when we were moved, the next step was to Christianize the Indians and to put them in boarding schools, the theory being to break the Indian culture and to make white people out of Indians. And it just didn't work. And there really are sad stories about the breakup of the families and the ties and the loss of the traditional skills that they had.
It was sad, you know, because the year we moved in 56, and we moved to Wishrap. I don't know, it was June or July, we all went to Celilo and burned the houses, because they told us to burn them down, so we went down there, and we burned our house, my grandmother's house, my uncle's house, my other uncle's house, and Matthew's house, and we all burned our own homes. And that was kind of sad. It was just something you never see again. And I remember I skipped high school, Wishram, the year they flooded the dam. The day they flooded it, I skipped school, went down to the train bridge and watched the Celilo being flooded. You know, watching it just get higher and higher and higher and higher and higher. And I remember watching that thing. Boy, just can't believe it. Just kept getting full up. The old folks were watching everything else, but I was by myself. I went down to the train bridge, and I imagine a lot of them cried. They ruined a lot of things. And other things have been, actually, they've been the same since. Then, you know, then younger people got mixed emotions and all that stuff. So it's really hard to say what it's like. For me, it's, you can't live in the past. You got to, you know, so I just went in the military and got out and kicked around for a while. And goofed off for a while. And then finally settled down and went to work.
People in the basket world, collectors, and those who are familiar with the local native cultures, are fascinated with the baskets and the designs. And I would say the majority are uncomfortable when I do variations of the designs. And my variations include putting modern dresses on the traditional geometric figures. And I like to experiment with colors, so I put bright colors on them. I'll weave beads in, too, to dress them up. And then the other thing I do, I'm concerned about the health of the river, the Columbia River. We have this great big place called Hanford, which did a lot of research in uranium and plutonium, and never really considering the side effect of what this is going to do to the land. Well, there's a big controversy over the radioactivity in the Columbia River. And people in the nuclear industry claim that it's there, but it's something we don't have to worry about in such small amounts. Those who know a lot about radioactive decay and realize that there's a thing called half-life, that there's no way you're ever going to completely get rid of it, are concerned because we're never told exactly whether it's uranium or plutonium or whether it's radioactive iodine and just what is it and what's the whole synergistic effect of all these radioactive products. We don't know that. But those of us who live along the river have seen maimed and deformed salmon, maimed and deformed sturgeon, and we know that there's a long-term effect. And if it's just now showing up, what's it going to be like in the next generations? So getting back to my baskets, I do a lot of the traditional salmon images, and one of the Wasco images that reflects strength and longevity is the sturgeon. And the sturgeon do get huge. They get to be over 6 feet. There's some of them that have been caught, and they're 8 feet. And they're big, and then they live a long life. So what I do on my designs is always put deformed sturgeon on my designs. And now people who know me real well come up and say, "Where's your Hanford sturgeon?" So that's what I call it, the Hanford sturgeon.
As Indian people, because of our relationship with the land, when we become an advocate for the land, for a healthy environment, we're an advocate for everyone across this land. Because the American Indian is a minority population, a minority landowner within their own homeland, they're still seen as a mystery, as an unknown. If we can break past some of the barriers that have either displaced or dismissed the wisdom or the abilities, the talents of Indian people, I think we can start reaching out to a broader community. You know, you listen to this world, and it's calling for cultural diversity. And to me, it's a cry for help. Because I think in order for us to survive and to be prosperous, you know, we need to bring in all the rich, diverse ideals and values which have survived the test of time. For Indian people, have survived in the face of adversity over all these years. But there's lessons, there's teachings there. And I think if we can help people understand, you know, our point of view, get past those old barriers that scare people away about Indian sovereignty, Indian treaty rights, and get rid of some of those misperceptions. Get through the smoke, the mirrors, and the clouds that are out there, and truly start interacting, helping people understand, you know, where our values are rooted and what our values mean. I think everybody is willing to accept a healthy environment, but at times, I think we always put the science, the technology in front in our debates. You know, and we need to put the spiritual part right up there too, because debates over the environment have gone well beyond, you know, the scientific and technological debates. And as Al Gore said, they now include moral debates. And I think we need to get people to begin to feel within their heart the passion and devotion that it is going to take to change the world and change the way that we look at the world, and not do it with just science and politics or technology and economics, but really to get back the human moral side of a healthy environment.
Many Indian people have retained the perspective of their forebears, a perspective founded in what poet and philosopher Gary Snyder calls the practice of the wild. Many remain attuned to their respective habitats and possess an intuitive and practical knowledge accumulated over countless generations of experience. For them, cultural diversity and biotic diversity are interlocked. This is true of indigenous cultures throughout the world. The eminent biologist Edward O. Wilson uttered a truth appropriate for all native peoples when he wrote the following, quote, "Unfortunately, much of the indigenous knowledge is being lost as European culture continues to intrude and the last preliterate native cultures in tropical countries weaken and disappear. We are losing irretrievably what is in a real sense scientific knowledge." Featured on this episode of The Spirit of Place have been Alan Pinkham, Jamie Pinkham, Pat Courtney Gold, Miley Lawyer, and Ed Edmo, all of whom are Indian people who reside within the watershed of the Columbia and Snake River system. Their points of view are included here with their individual written permissions. This 13-part radio series was produced for the Western States Arts Federation in association with KUNM-FM Albuquerque by Jack Leffler and Elaine Thatcher. Funding for this series was provided by the Ruth Mott Fund, the New Mexico Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Utney Reader Magazine, offering thought-provoking points of view on culture and society from over 2,000 media sources. Please visit Utney Reader on the World Wide Web at utney.com. That's www.utne.com. This is Jack Leffler inviting you to remain attuned to the spirit of place. Thank you for listening.